You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked a Texas law from going into effect this week that would have prevented large social media companies from blocking certain content. We'll talk to an attorney about where that case goes from here and what it means for you. Now, if you're looking to add some variety to your baking, try using some farro flour or einkorn berries or another heritage grain. Our next guest works with a variety of grains, growing them, milling, and cooking with them. She says using different grains can add great flavor and texture, give options for people with special dietary needs, including gluten-free options, and they can help the environment. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you gone against the grain with your cooking, using stuff apart from the typical all-purpose white and wheat flours? Do you use barley, farro, oats, durum, you name it? Have you found heritage grains accessible maybe in your local stores or markets? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Emma Zimmerman is the author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. She's officially been experimenting with milling grains since 2011 with her dad. Emma, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me. I'm excited to talk about these grains.
What got you and your dad into this wide variety of grains and flours and growing them and milling them in the first place?
Yeah, so we're in Phoenix, Arizona, and there is a heritage grain that's been in this region for a while called White Sonora Wheat. And that was kind of our first foray into this whole world of heritage grains. And we started growing it. We were 10 acres with a local farmer. Loved it. Got some excitement from chefs and local bakers. And that just kind of led to like discovering this whole world of grains that had been forgotten. And we're kind of, you know, just sitting in seed banks, not getting eaten or enjoyed.
So it sounds like fun growing it and milling it and all. But for maybe that home cook who's listening right now, if they asked, what's in it for me? What would you tell them about opening up their eyes to some of this variety?
Well, I could, you know, go on about like health benefits of whole grains and all that stuff. I love like getting people excited about the flavors and kind of like I always compare it to maybe coloring with you know, the 64 pack of crayons. Like you just have a lot more options and a lot more you know, that you can do with your creativity in the kitchen, having flour that's not just sort of like a white inert substance that doesn't quite offer anything. You know, it becomes more of a central player in your kitchen, which is really fun. The book, The Miller's Daughter, has 10 different grains and legumes, and there's just so many different ways that you can prepare these grains as well. So it's even beyond baking. If people aren't considering themselves bakers, there's something for everyone.
Well, let's check out one of the grains now. And I've used this. I don't actually know what it is. I don't even know if I'm saying it right. Farro, F-A-R-R-O. Is that right? Farro or farro?
Yeah.
Farro.
Yes.
Okay,
you
great.
Can say either way, actually.
Excellent. Good. And then, like I said, I've cooked with it. I've eaten it. I don't actually know what it is. What is farro?
So farro is a very old grain. We call it an ancient grain because it's thousands of years old. It's sort of a precursor to what we know as modern wheat. Some people call it farro because it is the pharaoh's wheat. It's a very old variety that probably ancient Egyptians were eating. And it's a really nutty, deeply flavorful grain. Yeah, you can cook it whole like rice. So there's a bunch of salads in the book. It makes such a great salad. And you can mill it and turn it into flour. There's a farro banana bread that has some chocolate in it as well. And those are some of my favorite recipes. Farro is pretty accessible as well right now. I think most people listening could probably find it either just in their local supermarket or at a local mill near them. But it's pretty well established here. It's really popular in Italian cooking as well.
Now we've got that recipe. You shared it with us. It's up at WPR.org/Food Friday, the chocolate flecked farro banana bread. So what is having farro? Now this is like, it's not the whole farro, as you said, it's like a farro milled flour. What does that do? How does it make the banana bread different?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so glad that you have that recipe up. That's kind of my go-to when people ask, like, where do we start, with this book? Because everyone, banana bread, like, pretty accessible. Everyone can make banana bread, I hope.
It's
And
not too hard. Even I can
so,
do it. Yeah.
yeah, it's not too hard. And I always have overripe bananas on hand. It always seems I'm like a little too ambitious buying bananas every week, but farro flour is a great swap for that white flour, and it's a great way to kind of taste the difference in adding a stone milled ancient grain flour into your baking. People always love that recipe. It's so fun to serve it to friends and family because it tastes familiar, but it just has that extra layer of something else. So it always kind of starts a conversation about these grains.
Talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains, Stories and Recipes from Hayden Flour Mills. You can join the Food Friday conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you like to cook or bake with different kinds of grains and flours? What are your favorites? What have you experimented with? Do you have a question for our guest? Maybe you tried it and it didn't come out so good. Maybe Emma could help you out. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. That's 800-642-1234. Emma, a lot of times we're going to buy flour already milled. What are options for getting something that's in, a harder, chunkier form if we want to get something and grind it up at home? Are there some we can do that with?
Yes, there you could get into home milling. It's not something that I've personally explored, seeing as I own a flour mill. I can just go get my
Fair,
flour
very fair.
there. But yeah, there you can home mill anywhere, from like a blender attachment to something like a little more substantial as a countertop mill or a hand mill. But that's really the ultimate. And that's how we got started, honestly, is my dad was baking bread, and then he started milling his own flour to kind of, enhance the fresh taste of his flour. And one thing led to the next, and all of a sudden the home countertop mill, got a little bit bigger and bigger and bigger until now we have a whole milling operation.
Mission creep for sure. Yeah. Let's check
Yeah.
out some other grains. Now, barley, I just think of barley as barley, and you go and buy a package with the word barley on it. There's different kinds of barley, and you've got, I think, purple barley, for example. Can you tell us about some of the variety in the barley world?
Yeah, so there is bronze barleys. We grow a variety of Tibetan purple barley. It's just really fun. It is purple in the field. Like, so if you were, flying overhead with a drone, you could actually see this lavender colored field. And then the seeds are very deep, rich purple. So just from that, like, it's so fun to cook with. There's a recipe in the book that's a barley lemonade and really pretty, like, violet purple color, and it's
Ooh.
very delicious and refreshing. And that's always really fun to surprise people with. But yeah, barley, I think, has kind of that like pearly stew reputation. And I tried to steer away from that and make barley a little more exciting. There's a lot of cuisines throughout the world that use barley as well, so a lot of inspiration there. But yeah, purple barley is the one that we grow and really love at the mill, even though there's a lot of different varieties. If your food can be more colorful, why not?
Well, here's the one that got me because I grew up with my Polish grandma's pierogies. And you've got a purple potato pierogi using ideally this purple barley. Tell us about this one.
Yes, so I hope someone will make this recipe, but
I might.
it's a
I might.
purple barley, dumpling and wrapper, and then the purple potato inside, so it's like purple on purple. I love cooking with color in mind, so anytime I can play with color and also make it delicious, I just can't resist. So that one was really fun to do. And yeah, like if you make bread with purple barley flour, that bread will have a lavender color. Like, it's just really fun.
It's Food Friday. We're talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flowers and Heritage Grains. She's talking with us about how we can experiment in the kitchen with more than just that all-purpose, say, white flour by using a lot of different heritage grains, other kinds of flours. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever tried milling your own flour from, say, wheat berries or whatever before? How did it go? Do you use different kinds of flours in your cooking or baking, different kinds of grains? If you are gluten-free for one reason or another, what kind of grains have you had success with where stuff comes out with great flavors and textures? Or do you have questions for our guest about what to do with all this stuff? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Remember, we got that banana bread made with Faro recipe. There's some chocolate in there too. Find it at WPR.org/Food Friday. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our Food Friday talk with Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flowers and Heritage Grains. After experimenting with growing and milling grains for more than a decade with her dad, Emma's with us to talk about using a lot of different types of grains and flours in our own cooking and baking. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your experiences using different grains, maybe growing or milling them yourself, or your questions, 800-642-1234. Linda joins us in Milwaukee. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
What do you want to tell us about?
Well, I happen to be Jewish, and, you know, we Jews have the holiday of Passover, and that lasts 8 days, and you were not allowed to eat any leavened products. Nothing with yeast, no leavening. And the reason for that is because when we had to leave Egypt, we had no time to let the bread rise. And so we have to be very ingenious, you know, because matzah is just flour and water. So I make something that's Persian. It's called a spinach mina. And what it is you wet matzah and you put it in an oiled or buttered or greased, whatever, 8-inch pan. I use glass. And then you layer in meat, cooked chopped meat. You can put almonds in it if you want to. And then I make about a 3-inch layer of that. And then you put another piece of wet matzah on top, and you pour a beaten egg over the whole thing and bake it.
Wow.
And it's absolutely delicious.
That sounds fantastic, Linda. Thanks a lot for sharing that with us. Emma, do you have favorite flours or grains that work well as a bread-like product that is unleavened, that's no yeast in the picture?
Yeah. Oh, that recipe sounded so
totally
good. Yes, there's a few cracker recipes in the book. That's with a type of wheat called Durum. It's a pasta wheat. We grow a heritage variety called Bluebeard Durum that has these blue awns on it, kind of creating this blue beard effect in the field. But that's a really delicious pasta wheat, and it also makes really great crackers because it gives that same kind of like firm crunch to it. But yeah, a lot of the recipes in the book, I don't do a lot of bread kind of baking. There's a few things, but not a lot of yeast. So it's not, you know, when people hear about ancient and heritage grains, they think of those sourdough kind of European style loaves. But in this case, I really wanted to showcase all the other ways that you could use these grains. Maybe if sourdough is a little bit intimidating or using yeast can be a little bit intimidating, but quick breads, crackers, whole grain salads, you know, waffles, pancakes, there's so many things that you can do with these grains. And in fact, it's almost better to keep things really simple. That way you can taste the actual flavor of the grain as you're baking.
Thanks a lot for that call, Linda, at 800-642-1234. Sharon joins us next in Appleton. Sharon, hi.
Hi, well, I'm gluten sensitive, not celiac, and I've used gluten-free grains for years. And I never buy gluten-free flours pre-mixed because they're just filled with potato starch and corn starch and no whole grains. So I keep about a dozen different gluten-free flours in my refrigerator almost any time. And I'll just take any recipe. I don't do yeasted things because that's too hard. But quick bread, cookies, pancakes, waffles, etc. If it says a cup of flour, I'll just grab maybe three different kinds of gluten-free flours, a third a cup of each, unless I'm using coconut. And then I use a little less because coconut soaks up the moisture just a lot. And then just start to play with how the different textures you get from the different flours.
Sharon, what are a couple of your what are a couple of your rock star flours that you go to?
Sorghum. So sorghum and coconut if you want something really moist.
Excellent.
And then if you want something a little bit lighter, and I will go with rice or millet. You know, for pancakes, I love buckwheat, a little buckwheat, but not straight.
Sharon, I gotcha. Thanks a lot for sharing all that with us. Emma, one thing that popped to my mind is you've got a whole chapter on chickpea flour in the book.
Yes. Yeah, so chickpea is also one of the gluten-free flours. There's a whole world. I mean, I covered 10 types of flours and grains, but there's, as Sharon mentioned, sorghum and buckwheat and so many other things you wouldn't typically think that you can turn into flour. Chickpeas are great because they're naturally gluten-free. They grow really well as a cover crop for wheat, so they're great to rotate in. You can make such amazing things from chickpea flour. There's a chickpea flour pound cake in the book that I really love with this tahini glaze and a baharat spice. You can make chickpea fries. Those always go really fast. But yeah, it's a really fun flour to kind of play with, and a great option if you're trying to stay away from gluten. I will say that a lot of our customers who come to us because they are gluten sensitive and they find that they can eat these older varieties, these heritage grains, these ancient grains with no reaction. So that's really hopeful too. Another reason that we think these grains are worth growing.
Thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Emma Zimmerman is with us on this week's edition of Food Friday. Her new cookbook is called The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains, Stories and Recipes from Hayden Flour Mills. Emma, let's talk about the grain that you mentioned earlier, started it all, that white Sonora flour. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, white Sonora wheat is the first wheat that came to North America. The legend is that it was brought over by Jesuit German missionaries, you know, bringing the foods from home. Also needed wheat flour to, you know, make the Eucharist. So it's been here in the Southwest for 400 years. So it became acclimated, what we call became a land race. One of the reasons we love it is because of that story and because it takes less water to grow, which is a huge thing for us here in Arizona. We need to take a lot of care with our water. So having a crop that's arid adapted is really great. So probably something we need to do more of in the future. It tastes great. It's so beautiful. I actually got married 10 years ago, and that was my wedding bouquet because I thought it was just so beautiful. So
awesome. Now, you mentioned some of the environmental benefits there. Can you talk? That's something you talk about a little bit in the book, and we've been focusing on, you know, cooking with the stuff. But what are some more of the environmental benefits of checking out these wider varieties of ancient grains?
Yeah, they are really great, especially in conjunction with regenerative agriculture practices. Are really great for the soil. They demand less inputs, so they can be, you know, a lower cost to a farmer, and yeah, lower water. That's all part of the story, you know, beyond just the flavor and kind of the excitement and the creativity that comes from using these grains. We also think they're kind of part of our future, and we need to go back and recover a lot of that biodiversity that we've lost in the industrial food system. And the best way to promote biodiversity in our food system is to eat these grains, and of course to have really good recipes that inspire people to use them.
There's been some chatter among Central Time producers about what your farm and operation looks like. Can you kind of paint us a picture of what we would see if we were taking a tour?
Oh, that's a great question. Yeah, so Hayden Flour Mills is actually a historic mill that started in Tempe, Arizona. But our mill is not located there anymore. We restarted the mill. It had been out of business for a while. So in 2011, my dad and I restarted it. And we actually are now located on the farm, kind of on the outskirts of Phoenix, where we grow a lot of our wheat. So it's very cool that we're kind of this vertically integrated mill. We have the farmer growing the fields, you know, just out the door. And then the seed cleaning operation right there next door to us. The mill, we have this beautiful Italian stone mill. It's still very artisanal. It's not a giant grain elevator that you might have, you know, seen in most states have these big mills. It's much, much smaller. And then it goes out the door right there. So it gets turned into pancake mixes, all these different kinds of flour. Flour for chefs and restaurants and bakeries, as well as flour for, you know, grocery stores. And then, of course, our online store, people, home bakers can just order directly from us. So, yeah, it's a really fun place to work. It's a fun place to be. We used to offer tours. We don't do that anymore since COVID. But we loved showing people, like, where their flour came from and connecting them directly with the source of their grains and flour.
Emma, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Emma Zimmerman, author of the cookbook, The Miller's Daughter, Unusual Flours and Heritage Grains. She joined us today to talk about why she enjoys using unique flours and grains in her recipes. You can find one of those recipes at wpr.org/foodfriday. It is a chocolate-flecked farro or farro banana bread. Again, find that at wpr.org/foodfriday. Maybe make some over the weekend and you can drop it off at the studio for me on Monday. That would work out really well, actually. That would work for me. Also, if you have experiences cooking, baking, whatever, with a lot of the different grains we've been talking about or others off the beaten path, you could tell us all about it. Let us know over on the Ideas Network Facebook page or send us an email, ideas@wpr.org. Maybe you've got a recipe of your own you'd like to share. Coming up Monday on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, meet the director of a Wisconsin office on school safety that's part of the state's Department of Justice. Learn about efforts to keep kids and staff safe, especially with a recent high-profile shooting in a school in Texas. Join that conversation and more. That's coming up Monday morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. We met the author of a new book on the history of Star Trek yesterday. No surprise, a lot of you called in with your thoughts and memories, and we heard from more of you on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'll share a few here. Chris writes, Star Trek Deep Space Nine was my favorite series by far. Wide array of compelling characters, many of whom straddled moral ambiguity and dualities. Sisko had quite a temper and was occasionally operating in gray areas for a Starfleet officer. Garak has a complex and private personal history, which made it difficult to know if he was friend or foe. She goes on with thoughts on other characters. Billy writes, my kids are sick of hearing me talk about how important Star Trek was. Rick says, big fan of Star Trek, binge watching everything. James says, Strange New Worlds, that's one of the new ones, is really, really good. And TV Tong says, a quote I love and believe in, it's possible to commit no mistakes and still lose. It's not a weakness, that is life, from Captain Picard. Our guest actually quoted that one yesterday, too. Still time for you to share your Star Wars favorites. Post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. This is Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+. The U.S. sends more missiles to Ukraine, millions in Shanghai get back to work, and Canada cracks down on handguns. The biggest stories from around the world today at 6 on 1A+. Now, the U.S. Supreme Court decided to temporarily block a Texas law that would have taken effect this week. The law would have limited large social media companies' ability to moderate content on their platforms. Supporters of the law have argued that those companies are silencing conservative viewpoints. The case again brings up the question of how the First Amendment should be applied to speech on the internet. Our guest says the laws in Texas and elsewhere get things wrong, but he says social media companies are making bad arguments too. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much ability should social media platforms have to limit what appears on their platforms? Where should the line be drawn? Who should draw it? How much should the government step in to regulate it? Call it at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Scott Wilkins is senior staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, where he focuses on freedom of speech online and government regulation of social media platforms. Scott, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks, Rob. It's great to join you.
Now, off the top, Scott, you are a lead counsel on an amicus brief that the Knight First Amendment Institute submitted in the Texas case. You have concerns about the Texas law and some others. What worries you about the way, say, Texas approached this issue?
Texas really has taken an extreme position that the First Amendment doesn't apply to social media platforms, that companies like Twitter and Facebook, they have no First Amendment rights when they offer their platforms to users. And in essence, that the state, that Texas, that state governments, and maybe even the federal government can wield enormous power over speech on these platforms.
So what exactly would this Texas law do if it ultimately gets approved in the court system?
It does really two things, and we view the two things a bit differently. The first is that it would prohibit the platforms from taking down content that the platforms don't want to publish. This provision basically says you can't take down any content because of its viewpoint. The law doesn't define viewpoint, but I think as understood by most reasonable people, it means that the social media platforms would have to host a lot of content that they find objectionable that they currently take down. The second thing that the law would do is it would require the platforms to disclose a range of important information to users and the public, commercial information of various kinds, some of it that has to do with their content moderation. And we think that the first thing I mentioned, this requirement to host content that you don't want to publish, that is very problematic. The second thing, the disclosure requirements, are a more difficult question under the First Amendment. And you know, we think that some disclosure requirements would likely pass a First Amendment test.
A lot of the motivation here seems to be concerns that some platforms, like Twitter, for example, treat conservatives unfairly, including blocking former President Trump after the January 6th insurrection. Some studies have suggested it isn't so much that conservatives are targeted, but that they run afoul sometimes of misinformation policies. How much is this partisan concern driving these kind of laws?
Well, the government in Texas, I mean, certainly the governor and various other officials in Texas made it very clear that that this law, HB 20, was motivated by the idea that these platforms silence or are biased against conservative voices. There's no secret about that. You know, but beyond that, it's really hard to know, you know, what was in legislators' minds or anything. It's just statements that were made by the governor and others in the state government.
Now, you've also written critically about some of the arguments coming from social media companies or organizations representing them and how they characterize their role and their relationship to the First Amendment. What do you see wrong on that side?
Yeah. So, you know, a moment ago I said Texas, you know, basically says that these social media companies have no First Amendment rights. And the social media companies kind of are on the opposite end of the spectrum. They say they have enormous First Amendment rights that basically any government regulation that implicates, that touches on their First Amendment rights is unconstitutional. So basically the government really can't do anything to regulate the social media platforms. And that we just think that's, you know, plainly wrong, just like the Texas position is wrong. And, you know, what we think is really important here is to understand that the government can have a positive role in regulating these platforms to ensure that the platforms serve our democracy. serve public discourse. And one of the ways that the government can do that is by requiring the platforms to disclose how they treat user content, how they moderate content, what their policies are. There are various ways that the government could require platforms to be more transparent, and that transparency could really serve the public.
And one of the tricky things here is kind of dueling metaphors about what a social media platform is. The argument, I think, from social media companies is, we're like a newspaper. So freedom of the press protections are there. We have a right to say what content does and doesn't appear on the stuff we own. The Texas law, and I think others say, no, you're more like a, you know, you're like the phone company. You don't get to decide who gets to call who and say what to whom. If I understand some of what I've read by you correctly, it's kind of a little of both and a little of neither.
Well, yes. I mean, in the sense that certainly when it comes to the newspaper analogy, I mean, we agree that there are some similarities. You have to really look at the specific activity you're talking about, and does that really look like something that similar to what newspapers do editorially? So we see some similarities there and some differences, and I'll come back to that. We don't really, I mean, it seems to us like the common carrier issue, the sort of, are you like, you know, the Telegraph or something, that's kind of in some ways an all or nothing question. So it's hard to be a little bit, you know, like the Telegraph. But on the First Amendment question and the newspapers, you know, there are some similarities, and the two ones that we point to that are important here are the ability to decide what you will and won't publish, what content you'll put up and what content you won't. And that seems very much like what a newspaper editorial room does when it decides what will appear in the newspaper and what won't appear. The other thing that seems quite similar to us is when a platform decides to label content, to actually speak itself about what's on the platform, that just seems to be a little bit like when a newspaper publishes an editorial.
We're talking to Scott Wilkins from the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, looking at social media and the First Amendment after the U.S. Supreme Court this week blocked, for now, a Texas law from going into effect. It would have stopped large social media companies from moderating certain kinds of speech on their platforms. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How much do you want social media companies to control what appears from users on their sites? Should they be able to restrict misinformation? Should they not be able to? Should the federal government do more to regulate? What questions do you have about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Scott Wilkins, senior staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University, looking at the ways that Texas and Florida are trying to regulate large social media companies and platforms in their states. This week, the U.S. Supreme Court blocked a Texas law from coming into effect. You could join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts, your questions, your opinions, and maybe your experiences encountering content moderation that blocked you or didn't block somebody you think ought to have been blocked. 800-642-1234 is the number. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Rochelle is with us in Minneapolis. Rochelle, hi.
Hi, thanks so much for having me. I'm in the car, so hopefully I am not breaking up.
Loud and clear.
Awesome, thank you so much. I work in the legal cannabis industry as a writer and journalist, and this is an issue that we face quite frequently in this space, and to a lesser extent, tobacco. So it's definitely not just political speech that's being targeted. Cannabis accounts are being flagged and deleted constantly with no chance to review. And what our understanding of it is mostly that social media companies are deploying to find content that they deem unacceptable or goes against their rules. And so I was hoping that you could speak a little bit to the technology to let people know how this content is being moderated.
Rochelle, thanks for the call. A complicated question, Scott. I imagine it's different from one platform to another. But in a case like this, a legal industry in some places, an illegal industry in others, how might that interact with moderation systems?
Sure. I will address that to the extent that I can.
Sure.
I'm not a technologist here, but the companies use a variety of methods, which they do disclose to some degree on their websites, whether they're automated methods like algorithms, whether they're other users flagging what other users do. And sometimes, it's actually just employees at the company that are assigned to review various kinds of content. So there's a real mixture of ways. But, one of the things that's really important from our perspective, in terms of the kind of disclosure and transparency of the platforms, is that there be some way for users to be notified when their content is taken down or some other adverse action is taken against their content, and also that users have a right to appeal. Those are at least important considerations. They are different from the government telling platforms what they must and must not host. But providing that kind of due process can be very important to protect the speech of users.
Rochelle, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Now let's go back to Texas now. We had the U.S. Supreme Court say, Texas, you can't enforce that thing for now. Why did they do that?
It's hard to know why the five justice majority did that. They didn't provide any explanation. So we really don't know. All that we have is the word of three justices in dissent, and really that's the only information that we have.
What did the dissenters say?
Well, they basically said, the first thing they said is this is an incredibly important question that will come before the court. So that's certainly a signal that at least three justices believe that this is an issue that belongs before the court. But they basically said that for various reasons they would have. So basically the Fifth Circuit, the intermediate federal court, had put the law, had allowed the law to go into effect. And the Supreme Court said, you know what, we feel like we shouldn't be stepping in here. This is not the kind of situation where we need to step in. We should have just let the lower courts do what they're doing. And we will hear the case when it eventually comes to us in the normal way. We'll do a full appeal if we take the case. But for right now, we shouldn't get involved. And the majority disagreed. And the majority said, nope, we're going to get involved and we're going to put this law on hold. They didn't say why, but they took that very important step here. And we think it was a really key step for free speech.
So what is next in the process from now until it gets back to the Supreme Court?
Basically, this case out of Texas, it's now back before the Fifth Circuit, the intermediate court. And the Fifth Circuit will at some point in the next weeks or months issue an actual decision on the merits, telling us what they think about this law, whether it's unconstitutional, constitutional, parts of it maybe constitutional or not. And then it's very likely that either side or both sides will appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And the court may very well take that case because it is so important. There is another case out of Florida that's currently in another court of appeals. That case will also likely be appealed to the Supreme Court. So they'll have more than one chance to take up this general issue.
Now, something that's weird, this is Texas issuing a law here. There's no such thing as Texas Twitter. It's interstate, international. What happens when a state tries to regulate something that clearly flows through its borders, but also beyond its borders?
Well, it's really hard to know here, partly because, obviously this is the internet, as everyone knows. It doesn't end at state borders, nor do these companies' operations. And, we really don't know what the company's options are because we don't really, see under the hood and know what all the operations are. So it's just hard to know. For example, here, that these two laws have been passed, one in Texas, one in Florida. They're different. They have some similarities, but they're different. So if you're Facebook or Twitter, how would you comply with both of them at the same time? I think that would be certainly a challenge for these companies. But we feel strongly that the key provisions of the Texas law and also the Florida law are unconstitutional. And so we hope that the social media companies will not have to have to deal with these the key parts of these statutes, which prevent them from taking down content they want to take down.
If they do end up getting approved by the U.S. Supreme Court, what could that end up meaning for, say, Twitter or Facebook and their ability to limit content, not just, you know, political content or whatever, but stuff that I think a lot of people would agree they don't want to see on their social media feeds?
Well, that's certainly one of the things they've been saying, and we think it's generally right that the Texas law, for example, as I said earlier, if it went into effect, it would require them to publish a lot of content that I don't think anybody really wants to see. I mean, we're talking about glorifications of violence, suicide, pornography, hate speech, all kinds of things that the platforms currently try to take down. They may not succeed all the time. They may make mistakes, but these are things that I don't think anybody wants to see, and I think the platforms would be prevented from taking those steps.
Scott, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks very much, Rob. It's been great being here.
Scott Wilkins, a senior staff attorney at the Knight First Amendment Institute at Columbia University. He was with us today to talk about the First Amendment and the internet and social media. That's after the U.S. Supreme Court blocked a Texas law from going into effect this week. That law would have prevented social media companies from being able to moderate a lot of content on their platforms. For almost 60 years, Racine's Rotary Club has been throwing a massive post-prom party. It's a place where students can show off their outfits before partying in an alcohol-free environment after their school dances. And this year, after 2 years of rescheduled, virtual, or masked celebrations, the event felt a little more special. Madeline Fox takes us to prom night.
Family members started gathering in the bleachers at the Racine County Fairgrounds an hour before students from 9 high schools started arriving. Their seats faced a track where students drove by in their motorcade, and past that, a red carpet. The motorcade and red carpet are part of an annual Racine tradition that goes back to 1953. It brings together students from area public and private schools, and their cheering families and community members watching it live on public access TV for an after prom party. This year, it was a taste of joy and normality after 3 years when that's been harder to come by.
Our freshman year is probably the only normal year we've had. So, I mean, having our senior year be normal is pretty nice.
That's Alina Gomez, prom queen at Union Grove High School. Alina's mom went to post-prom when she was in high school, too.
My mom showed me her old prom videos, like on the, the VHS tapes or whatever they're called.
This year's red carpet had a spot just past a rose-covered archway where students could stop to get their pictures taken. Many had dates, but others came in groups of friends, like Union Grove senior Emily Patterson, who looked everywhere for her dream dress.
We had to go to a lot of different places, but I ended up getting my dress from Windsor. I always end up getting my dresses from Windsor, but I very much wanted a purple dress, so that's where I found mine.
Her friend Grace Moore wore red with elbow-length black gloves.
I also got my dress in Windsor, but it was the last one on the rack, so I had to squeeze into it no matter what. And it was like, I was so lucky I found it because there was nothing else.
And Maddie Good, another friend, went online for her black jumpsuit.
I got mine from good old Amazon, Mr. Jeffrey Bezos. Coming in clutch.
The dresses were a hit with spectators, too. Sandra Evans and her nieces came to watch Sandra's daughter, Janessa, a senior at Case, walk the red carpet.
I think that's great to see all the dresses, you know, and that's very, very pretty.
My favorite dress is Janessa's.
What is she wearing?
She's wearing
a red dress.
And it has, like, gems on it.
The biggest entrance of the night came from Bennett Wilkes and his date Liliana Kading, who rode in on one of the Wilkes family's tractors while onlookers cheered and crowded to the fence to take photos.
Our family farm's like 2 miles from here, so that was one of our tractors. My dad was actually the one that gave me the idea last year when my brother had prom here, so yeah.
The 2020 post-prom was virtual. Last year's was back in person, but students had to wear their masks everywhere but the red carpet. For some parents, this year's post-prom offered a second chance to celebrate their kids. Vivianne Augustus was cheering her daughter Asia on from the sidelines. One of her sons was a senior in 2020.
They didn't have one, and that was my son's prom, so they didn't have one, so this is like my first time down here. She's my last one. I had two boys, and she's my baby. So this is my last one, so I don't know what I'm going to do with myself now.
The students were having fun. They were catching up with friends, taking photos for Instagram, and dancing to hits, mostly from the early 2010s. Two girls karaoke'd to Carrie Underwood's Before He Cheats.
Love
students could also see they were lucky to get to celebrate together. St. Catherine senior Nevaeh Inocencio Martinez came with her date, Elijah Matthews, in matching iridescent white outfits.
Everybody looking healthy and everybody's able to enjoy this moment together after, you know, the pandemic and stuff. Because, you know, there was one year when a class didn't have a, you know, prom. And we're grateful that we did.
This year's graduating seniors can claim three of the weirdest, most unprecedented high school years in recent memory. They're going on to jobs and college knowing that it's probably not over yet, and it's even harder than usual to predict what those next years will hold. But they're also finding joy when they can. Madeline Fox, Wisconsin Public Radio.
Coming up Monday on Central Time, Congress is considering gun legislation after the latest wave of mass shootings, and President Biden made the case for some of those changes in a speech yesterday, but it's still a tall order with Republican arguments against those measures. We'll find out what's on the table and what could pass. And as always, you can weigh in with your thoughts on the ideas on the table. Plus, we'll meet the creator of a Milwaukee web program that's encouraging kids to read. And we'll get some great summertime reading suggestions along the way. If you have a favorite kids book you want to share with us, email right now, ideas@WPR.org. That and more coming up Monday on Central Time. Coming up after the news, WPR Capitol Bureau Chief Sean Johnson joins us to talk about the latest election news, including former President Trump's endorsement of a Republican candidate for governor. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.